Good morning. It's 6 a.m. It's a beautiful morning and I'm about to spend the day on the road. This podcast is very definitely a mobile one. So it's now about 8:30 in the morning and I am sitting in a car park. Actually, I'm waiting to go and have a cup of tea. I've arrived a little bit early. My client always likes to be early. So I'm going to go grab a cup of tea. But I thought I'd just kick this podcast off. I'm now down in Canterbury. I've never been to Canterbury before. But this podcast is going to be about print competitions. And this stems from a thing that a couple of the Master Photographers Association regions have done, which is to grab myself and a couple of other judges and do a sort of live critique, live come judging of prints. And we actually, instead of judging in silence, which we do when you're actually working as a competition judge, is we judged it by verbalising it. So you could kind of hopefully hear a little bit of the thought process. So myself, David McDonald and Hosmer Darvey, who all judge for the different associations, got together and talked through different images. We didn't always agree. In fact, we rarely all agreed. We did on some. But it was just going through the process of showing photographers how judging is done and what we look out for. So as some background before I go into the things I noted during the time I've been judging, the judging process is nearly always done by a panel of judges. There's normally sort of five of them, certainly with the MPA and the SWPP. There are five judges plus two spare judges. So that if an image comes up that one of the people sitting knows or doesn't feel they are qualified to judge, they can bring in for that one, they can recuse themselves and bring in another judge. The judging is done in silence. If there's a big disparity between the highest and lowest scores, then there's an automatic challenge, in which case we all discuss the image, starting with the person who scored either highest or lowest, depending on the circumstances. And you can also raise a challenge. So if you feel an image hasn't achieved a score you feel it should, either it's too high or it's too low, you can challenge and then you get to talk to the image and every other judge gets to talk about it too, and then at the end, whoever originated the challenge gets the final say, the rebuttal, and then it's rescored. Each image is scored on different a different score boundary. Each association has a slightly different version of that. But what we're trying to do is rank the images. At the end of judging all of the images in a particular section, the top scoring images will be put up together, and only then do we decide the winner and the second and the third. Okay, that's quite important because during a long day of judging, the marks may well drift up and down a little bit. Let's say straight after lunch, they might be slightly high, or late in the afternoon, the marks might come slightly lower. And so instead of saying, well, the highest scoring image is the winner, what we do is we take all of the highest scoring images, look at them all together, and then rank them from there. So occasionally the winning image is not the image that scored with the highest score on the day. And that takes out any variations during the day. So that's the process. Each of the associations has ever so slightly different ways of doing it, whether it's the BIPP, the SWPP, or the MPA, or any of those associations abroad. But all of them will have some kind of process that involves a multitude of judges, and we're looking for certain things. So this podcast is going to be about the notes that I took while judging. Every time the judges got agitated about something or they talked about something, I would write some notes, and I took note of a few. And these are the bullet points that I noted during that day, and that's what I'm going to talk about in this podcast. Well, I am after I've had a cup of tea. I'll talk to you in a bit. Well, when I set out to do this podcast, I thought I would park up somewhere and record for a few bits because I've got some gaps during the day. Little did I think I'd be parked up on the M20, which is where I am right now. I've just spent a happy couple of hours photographing with my client down in Canterbury, somewhere I've never been. Funnily enough, it's a beautiful place, but it turns out the roads out of there are prone to being, well, log jammed. So anyway, I thought I'd carry on, Oblivious. If you can tolerate the noise of the Land Rover engine in the background, I do apologise. I know it's not ideal, but nonetheless, it's a useful use of my time. So on to things about what to consider when entering prints for competition. Now, all of these comments are, all of these observations rather, are from my time judging. They're things I've heard judges say, or they're things I've noticed while we're judging. So don't take them as necessarily no image that has any of these considerations can win. Of course they can. It's just that these were recurring themes that I noticed. They were the same things I presented at the West Midlands, or we presented at the West Midlands the other day, but they're just maybe in a little bit more detail and a little bit more thorough. Now, the thing about competitions is to remember that you have to enjoy competitions. If you're going to do competitions, you've got to love them, okay? Whether it's at a camera club, whether it's at a national, whatever it is, you've got to enjoy them. If you don't enjoy losing, don't enter. Because at least in some, no matter how good you are, you're going to lose. And if you don't enjoy that, don't put yourself through it. Go for qualifications instead, because it's a lot less stressful. Of course, winning a competition is wonderful. So anyway, on to, with no further ado, well, there will be lots of further ado, of course there will, as I try to drive a car at 1 mile an hour through what looks like half an hour of traffic jams. Okay, so the first thing on my list, I've written down, careful of gloss paper. Now, that's a pretty wide sort of thing to say. And the reason I noticed this one is some of the images that came in to the competitions, particularly those images that weren't then mounted onto boards, so they were slightly curled, are hard to judge because the light striking them creates massive reflections. Now, I'm not saying that every image that came in on gloss paper didn't do well. I'm just saying, be very careful of using it, because if you do use a gloss paper, you're going to have to make the judges angle against the light, look at the image in different angles to try and get a picture of the whole image. And in certain lighting conditions, you can't ever see the whole image without light reflecting from it. Now, certain images look brilliant in gloss paper. A commercial image that came up in the judging the other night actually looked fantastic on gloss paper. It was the perfect image for it. It's a picture of, I think it was a glass of gin or something. I can't remember what the drink was, but an excellent, wonderful picture. And the way it was shot, the way it was finished, and the way it was printed onto the gloss paper looked fantastic. But that's not always the case. So just be careful of using gloss paper. On that note, be very careful of using matte fine art papers. They're not always the right choice, because of course where gloss paper gives you an incredibly wide contrast ratio, the widest of all of the photographic papers, matte gives you precisely the opposite, or fine art papers give you precisely the opposite. They give you a diminished contrast ratio, and that has its own challenges. Now, some images, so some of the fine art children's portraiture that we're seeing at the moment works really well on a fine art matte paper. But if you're just doing fairly conventional, and by conventional I just mean the way it's lit and treated, not necessarily that you're not taking beautiful pictures, but fairly conventional studio images, they're not going to work quite so well on a matte fine art paper, because there's no black. That goes down as far as a sort of muddy grey, but you never get a completely solid black, even if you're using matte black inks. Okay, so just be careful of matte paper. Now, in terms of printing in general, be sure, if the competition rules allow it, to mount your print or print it flat on board. A lot of the prints that came through, because when you send them, they're all pristine and they're wrapped up, and you pop them in your courier or in the recorded delivery to get them sent, or you hand deliver them, they're still flat. By the time they've been sat around a bit, they've been put in vans, they've been delivered to the, wherever the competition is being run, you find that they curl. Very often they curl. And we spotted a couple of quite common problems. One was that if an image was mounted into a mat, but it didn't have a backing board, so it was just taped into the mat. Quite often the board would curl slightly and the print would warp. That's not good. Another problem was just that the boards curled in general. So it does distract from your image. Remember, at the end of the day, you're being judged for your ability to create an impact. And that impact may well extend to how the print turns up. You can't help it. I mean, it's not what we're judging. But if it's all wrinkly and it's peeled away from its edges or it's not mounted at all, your initial impression is reduced. And your initial impression is part of the judging criteria. It's the initial impression of the image, but if the image is being destroyed by what it's mounted on, then don't do it. I photographed a regional competition recently for a group of artists, and there was a photographic category. Well, about 80% of the prints were mounted on sugar paper. The prints were slightly warped, they'd been pinned to the wall. They didn't look great even before I'd walked up to them and really had to investigate what had been created inside the print. So be careful of your presentation, all right? The best presentation I saw at the SWPP, and I'm not saying that it won necessarily, but it was, in my mind, in my opinion, it was the best presentation, was where the image had been printed down onto a pre-laminated, so it's pre-boarded or pre-mounted fine art paper. In fact, this was a matte paper, but it was so beautifully done. So the print, the paper had already been bonded to the board, as far as I could tell, and then that board and the print and the paper had then been printed on. It had been run through a fine art matte printer and printed on. Now, my printer will do that. I've got an Epson 3880. Not every printer will, but there are printers out there, so trade printers, who will supply you with a fully finished mounted print. And the print just looked wonderful. It had a board around it. It was printed straight onto the paper. It had a really clean, crisp edge. It was inside the outer light. So the board was 20 by 16. The print was something like, 18 by 12 or something, with a nice, clean, straight edge printed straight down onto it. It looked absolutely fantastic. So just bear that in mind when you're doing your printing. Next thing, this list is random, by the way. It's not in any particular order. It's just what I observed and made notes of. Catch lights in the eyes of your sitter, of your subject. Now, this is really important for portraiture. It's really important for wedding photography. It's really important for commercial, for fashion, and for pets. Anything that has a face in it needs, in my opinion, a good reason not to have catch lights in the eyes. Now, there are some phenomenal images that I have seen where there's no catch lights in the eyes. I'm not saying you can never do it. In fact, I shot some the other day deliberately. But the eyes must have life about them. They must look alive. They must sparkle. The eyes are always what we read first as humans. And that includes if you're photographing pets, because you are then going to look for human characteristics. It's very the process of photographing pets is very anthropomorphic. And by that, I just mean the more you can create human-type traits in a pet portrait, the more people are going to like it. So you will find that any images that have catch lights in the eyes will tend to do better than images that don't. Trust me, this came up. There's a couple of great images, and the comment from the judges was the eyes look dead. The eyes have no life in them whatsoever. They look dead. So you must do that. You must make sure that there is life in the eyes. And to do that, you have to have catch lights in the eyes. It's really important. So don't neglect catch lights in the eyes. Equally though, many judges are not big fans of having double catch lights. And by that I mean, when you've shot an image, usually in the studio, where you've used two sets of lights, where you've used two lights to balance out the contrast, you don't want both catch lights in the eye. Now, that's distinct and different to when you use a reflector below the chin to generate a gentle catch light under the eye. That's not quite the same thing. But when you have two catch lights, one either side of the eye, it creates a very snake eye. I heard one of the photographers the other night, Chris Bradbury, a great photographer, he mentioned this. He calls it snake eyes, and he's right. Try not to create snake eyes. Anyway, on that happy note, as you can probably hear from the engine accelerating, whatever accident I've just come through has ceased to be, and so I shall sign off for a sec and come back when the road is a little quieter. Ah, well, that's been a long day. But finally, I'm back. I'm just sitting. Let me describe the scene in front of me. It is about 7:30 in the evening. So that's 7:30 for our American friends. I am sitting on the edge of a beautiful cricket green. It's Dinton Cricket Green, cricket pitch, and watching my son, well, there's hundreds of kids here, from all nationalities, all areas, all practicing their cricket. And my son is one of the coaches. So he's coaching some of the lads. What's he doing now? He's batting. He's coaching some of the batsmen, which is great to watch. The sun is setting, so there's long, long shadows across the green. It's beautiful. There's the sounds of people laughing, the sounds of cricket balls being thumped by willow. It's just lovely, and it's been a long day. So I'm going to finish this podcast sitting here waiting for Jake to finish. So where did I get to? Right, I've just done Cat Sights in the Eyes. My final note on that, before I got rudely interrupted by the vagaries of traffic on the M20, is if you're going to use reflectors underneath the face or use a secondary light to light under the face, the catch light from the light underneath should never be stronger than the catch light from the top, except in exceptional creative circumstances. If you're trying to do something specific, that's of course fine, but don't accidentally leave that catch light much stronger than the upper catch light. Okay, try and make sure that the eye always looks natural, even if you do that really striking beauty setup where you have four strip lights set up in a square around the face. So in fact, you've got four catch lights in the eye, oil of Olay and those kinds of things. Peter Hurley talks about that setup. You still have to do it subtly, so it doesn't just look like the black of the pupil has this white square around it. It looks really odd. Again, except in certain circumstances when you're going deliberately for that look, check the catch lights in the eyes and try to make sure that there's always tone in there. It's not pure white. If your supporting catch lights are stronger or lighter or brighter than the upper catch light, your main catch light, then just be careful and try and tone those down. Next point I noted, print your image with a border so it can be picked up to be judged. Okay, this is a very practical tip. It's not about the image itself, but about how you hand it over to be judged. The MPA, the Master Photographers Association, their prints are shown individually one by one to each judge. So the print is picked up by a print handler who walks it from Judge A to have a look, then Judge B to have a look, then Judge C to have a look, D, E, and then it gets put onto the light box, which means in that process, the print handler has to hold the print somewhere. And if you've printed all the way to the edge, each judge is having to evaluate the print with two great white gloved fingers holding it, okay? It's just a practical thing. Bring your print in, bring your image in away from the edge of the paper so that there is something for the judge to hold without interrupting the enjoyment of your image. It's just practical, okay? Edge-to-edge prints look beautiful, but this is about getting your image to be judged well in a competition. So it's just a practical tip. Cropping. Oh, well, here we go. I wrote down, be bold, but check for edges, symmetry, vertical and horizontal, thirds, golden ratios. So let's go through all of those. Edges, edge cropping. Check that you haven't just run your crop through something near an edge that just makes it look odd. Okay, try and contain things either inside your print or kick them outside. Don't run the line of the crop through the middle of things, unless it's a creative decision, okay? Typical things, running a vertical crop down the middle of a lamppost. There you go, I saw that half a dozen times. It just looks wrong, it looks really weird. Unless there's some aspect of the image that kind of works, try and avoid things like that. Don't crop, obviously, through knuckles, joints, in hands and arms. Don't run the crop across the bottom. So if you're running the crop across the bottom and you've got folded arms, be careful if you're going to run the crop through the middle of the arm, where it's horizontal in the arms folded position. Be careful of running it down the sides of an arm, because it creates these really weird senses of what's going to happen outside the frame. That's all that happens, is your imagination fills in the gaps, the bits of the image that you've cropped out. And if you've cropped badly, it fills those missing bits badly. So just watch for your, it's called edge cropping detail or edge cropping, and just watch for that. Symmetry, I saw this beautiful image actually, it was three arches, three beautiful arches with a bride and groom in the middle arch. And I've seen various combinations of it. But the middle of the middle arch wasn't in the middle of the page. It was just off, just enough. So it wasn't a deliberate decision. It was just off just a bit. So the centre of the central arch was just to one side of the print. And you could see it because the other verticals, the supporting pillars of the arches, you could see it on the page. They were off to the side. And it just looked really odd. Everything else about it was perfect, except it was all off. It was like the printer had misaligned the print. And be very careful to make sure your crop is, if you're going for symmetry, make sure you nail the symmetry. Verticals and horizontals. One error I see, and I see this at all levels, except when you get, you should never see this from a fellow or an associate, but you see it at all levels. I see it in camera clubs and I see it in professional photography. If you've got something that obviously has to be horizontal, and by that I usually mean water, don't crop it so that it's an angle. Don't align it so it's at an angle. Make sure water surfaces in particular are horizontal. Now, I know if you're at the edge of, let's say, a bay, and the bay goes in and comes out and you've got the shoreline in the shot, of course, that's not going to be horizontal because that's perspective. It's coming towards you and wrapping round. That's different. If you've got a far horizon and it has water on it, it should be horizontal. End of conversation. Unless you've cropped in so tight that you can't tell that it's water, and then it doesn't really matter. You'd be surprised the number of times I've judged this and seen what clearly has to be a horizontal line is off at an angle. Buildings, again, they need to be vertical on the whole. Again, unless you're making a creative decision. And it's hard sometimes for a judge to know whether you're being creative or you simply missed it. So if you're going to be creative, make sure it's clear and apparent you're being really nice and creative. But if you're just a little bit off on the vertical, then of course that's going to look odd. Now here's the thing about cropping. The general rule of thumb, if you want to align a print or an image so that the verticals look correct, the middle of the image should be pointing straight up. Okay, think about it. If you've got multi-point perspective, the midpoint of the image, the converging verticals will converge to a point along that middle line. It'll be perfectly vertical. You can angle the camera back, angle it forwards, it doesn't really matter. That vertical line will fall down the middle of the print. Now, here's where it gets a little bit tricky. When you recrop that image, so let's say you have a pillar. Let's say you have three pillars, one, two, three, across the print, and you've got a low camera angle, so the pillars are now converging upwards to the middle. Okay, so you're lying on the floor, the pillars are wide at the bottom of your print and are narrow at the top. The middle print, the middle pillar is vertical. If you crop it so it only has two of the pillars, what do you have to do? Well, of course, you have to now tilt the crop as well so that the middle point of the arch, because that's now in the middle of your print, the middle of that arch now is the new vertical because you've just retwisted it. So where before the vertical was the middle pillar, if you recrop that image, so that middle pillar is at the right of your image, let's say, and it's still vertical, it's going to look wrong. You have to rotate the crop as well so that it points, so the middle of the arch is now the vertical and the two pillars converge upwards. All right, so you have to always look at the final crop. Just because you had the camera horizontal when you took the picture, if you recrop it, then you've got to tilt the camera angle for you to allow that to look correct in the new crop. So always look at your final crop. As a guide for me, when I'm cropping, I always have two monitors running. So I have one monitor that shows me the crop tools, and then I have another monitor showing me what the final image is going to look like. And that final image is really, really important because it shows me, without all of the crop marks and everything else on it, exactly how the image is going to look. Thirds and golden ratios, of course. If you're going to put your subject anywhere on the frame, then you need to make sure that it's cropped creatively. Don't be wishy-washy. Thirds, golden ratios. Now, it doesn't have to fit these rules, but remember this. All of the rules around composition in photography have been developed over many years because they feel pleasing to the eye. They're not really rules. They're just historically, they are things that people have noticed look really good. That's it. That's all. They just look really good. Over a period of time, people have realised that thirds, golden ratios, intersecting lines, the diagonal with the orthogonal the diagonal with a perpendicular intersection, they look really good. They're just techniques for an image having balance. That's all. And over many, many, you know, generations, people have realized that certain things work really well. So that's why we look for those things. And it's not that, oh dear, the photographer hasn't put it on the thirds. That's not at all right. It'll be, oh dear, that crop doesn't look right. I wish they'd put it on the thirds. It's always about what looks right. Sometimes an image looks great with the subject not on the thirds. You can do that. Of course you can. But if the image just looks wishy-washy, we're going to pick it up. It'll feel like you're being critiqued on your not following the rules, but that's not true. It just would have looked better had you found some placement slightly different, and probably the best place to look is on the traditional rules. Next point, overly processed, especially skin. Yes, I am not a fan of Portrait Professional and tools like it. If you are going to do skin softening, learn how to do skin softening, okay? Learn it. It's out there on YouTube, or ask your mentor, or come and talk to one of us who does this stuff. You must learn how to do skin retouching really, really well. In the process of judging, not once, no, that's not true, once I heard someone say, it's a shame about that blemish on the skin, they could have photoshopped that out. I heard probably 20, 30, maybe 40 times that skin looks overly processed. Think about it. 30 or 40 times we heard people being criticized for overly processing skin. Once I heard someone say, oh, it's a shame they didn't remove that, whatever it was, a blemish or something on the skin. So if you're at all uncertain about it, don't do it, okay? If you're not 100% certain about your skin retouching technique, just don't bother. Remove, you know, spots and a few bits and pieces if you have to, and then leave the image alone. It'll be rawer. Yes, it might not look like a fashion cover and a retouch beauty shot, but then, you know, neither will it if you don't know what you're doing. And Portrait Professional, trust me, is not the answer. It always makes the skin look kind of plasticky, and we don't. And if the judges spot it, the thing with all of this is when a judge spots something, it's hard to unspot it. So with five judges or multiple judges, if one judge says, you know, if it goes to a challenge and we have to talk about the image, if a judge says, I don't like the skin because, no, they won't say I don't like, if the judge says the skin retouching is overdone, we'll all look at it. And if once we start to see it, you can't unsee it. So you have to make all of your edits really gentle, really transparent. Don't overdo anything. If you think you're just teetering on the edge of it, you have already gone too far. Back off those layers by, I don't know, 70%. Back them off down to 30% opacity and see if it looks a little bit more natural. So be very, very, very careful of overly processed skin. We saw so many examples of that over the years. It's unreal. Horses and dogs, correct posing. This came up because I saw one image in particular. Now, I thought the image was exceptionally well done. It was beautifully lit. It was beautifully staged. It was a great location. But one of the judges, who is someone who has owned pointers, knew that that's not how a Crufts judge would mark a pointer stance. Okay, now it's quite a specific thing, but it got me to thinking that if you're going to shoot pets, be careful if you're going to start using poses that like a Crufts or a Kennel Club judge would be judging a dog on, because those breeders who do that kind of thing know the precise pose for that dog. And if you don't use that precise pose when you're shooting that style of image, a judge may well pick up on it and just say, look, this photographer isn't quite certain what they're doing. The pose is off. And then again, it comes back to that thing. Once you see it, you can't unsee it. Obviously, with dogs running and dogs sitting and ears cocked and all those kind of things, you have a lot more latitude. But if you're going to go for proper classical poses, as in the Kennel Club poses for dogs, you need to go out and learn what those poses are. Similarly with horses. Now, I'm not an equine photographer, so I bow in deference to equine photography because I don't really know all of the tricks and tips for it. But a few images came up, and a couple of the judges who do equine photography said that's not how you get the expression, that's not how you light it, that's not how the ears work. So go and do your homework. I can't give you advice on that because I simply don't know it. Okay. Muddy vignettes. Now, this is one that I'm really prickly about. Vignetting is a subtle art. You can't just use a Lightroom preset to dull down the corners of your frame. We saw loads of images where the corners just went muddy. Yes, they were darker, but they looked muddy. It really didn't seem to work. I don't know. I'd have to go and interview each competing photographer to find out exactly what they'd done. But my suspicion is they were using Lightroom to create a graded filter that just brought the exposure down. That's not the way to do it. There are many ways of doing a vignette, but just applying a grade or a circle where it's darker in the corners is not right. You've got to be subtle with it. One thing is that if you look at a natural vignette, it tends to push down the mids and the shadows into the darkness, but you still should have, it for it not to look like it's artificial, you should still have highlights popping through. So if you, let's say you have a specular highlight on a wine bottle in the corner of an image, if you just bring down the exposure, that specular highlight will go down with it, and it shouldn't. A specular highlight is a specular highlight, full stop. It will always be there. Okay, if you apply a vignette, that specular highlight should cut through the vignette. That's the trick. So look carefully at how light actually works. Even if that bottle was in the shadows, if it's catching a light, that catch light on the side of the glass will still be almost 100% white. Okay, that's how specular highlights work. Another thing about vignettes, a good way of checking to see if you've got your vignettes right is to look at the grid view in something like Lightroom or Bridge, where you're looking at small thumbnails of all of the images. Because in there, you will see really clearly any image that has a vignette that's visible. When you look at them at full screen, you get a bit lost in the image and all that detail, but when you look at them as thumbnails, you can suddenly see exactly how the vignette is being done. You can see it a mile away, all right? A vignette, you can heavily vignette an image, but it should never look like it's been vignetted. It should just look like the picture was darker in certain areas. And vignettes are rarely circular. For my money, I think you, there's also techniques, but you find ways of darkening the bits that should be dark, and you use the darkness to guide the user, or guide the viewer rather, into the bit of the image that you're interested in them looking at. A subtle thing, but it's really important. Next bullet point, hold the details in the shadows and also in the highlights. Again, with judging, let's say on a normal judging, the judges may have 3,000 images to go through over a couple of days, and their job is to bring that list down to, let's say, 20. Those 20 are going to win categories, and then one of them is going to be the overall category winner, or maybe two or three if you've got weddings, commercial, portraits, I don't know. But you really are, as a judge, trying to find ways, legitimate ways, of bringing that number right down. So all sorts of things are important. This one is a basic one, but of course, the minute someone says the shadows are blocked up, then that image is likely to score low. Similarly, if we're starting to see paper white through the image, this is about prints primarily, then again, blown highlights, the print is going to get a really low score. When you print your image, always make sure you never have paper white showing through. There are many ways of doing it. One of the simplest is in your Photoshop file, place a levels layer as the top layer. When you've finished all of your edits, place a levels layer. And on the levels layer, there's the histogram with its three separate little triangles that are adjustable. And under that, there's a little grade, a grade bar with two triangles. Those two triangles set the brightest and darkest points of the image. Okay, they set how much ink is going to be laid down. So if you drag the right-hand triangle in a little bit, let's say to a value of 250, what that means is the brightest part of the image will only print a white value on paper of 250. Similarly with the black slider, the one on the left, drag that up a little bit to, let's say, 5, and that means no part of the print will print pure black. It'll be just a little bit above black. Now, where you'll notice this, and you can try it on a print, is if you get pure white in a part of a print and you hold the print to the light and move it around, you'll see that the reflectivity of the paper is different where there's no ink. There are very few ink and paper combinations where that doesn't happen. It's not quite so bad on fine art matte papers. You won't see bronzing to quite the same extent if you use the right inks, but you certainly will on luster and gloss. If you tilt and move the paper around, it's called bronzing, this effect, you'll start to see when you look just at the reflection of light off the surface of the print, you'll start to see different areas where the light reflecting is odd. You'll see it's almost like it's got a texture to it. And that's where there's less ink, and in some cases no ink, on the page. And again, as the print is walked around, the judge is going to spot it, and then you're going to get penalised. Textured backgrounds in post-production. This is my next point. Textured backgrounds in post-production. We see a lot of images where they're a studio image and clearly the texture in the background has been put on later. If you're going to do that, do it well, because if it gets at all noticed and if it doesn't work for the image, and if the texture, let's say, bleeds over into the subject, on top of the subject, or for instance, here's my particular thing that I look out for, is if the background is not the same out of focus as it should be. So let's say you're shooting a studio shot at f5.6, and the background is a couple of feet behind your subject. That background texture should be slightly blurred. You can't have pin sharp texture in a bit of the photo where the camera would have blurred it had it been there in the original image. You also can't have background texture bleeding over your subject. You also can't have background texture where the light on the texture is so completely different to the subject it becomes obvious. You can't just bung a background into a picture and expect it to work. Okay, the background has to be sympathetic. It has to be in tune with the back, with the foreground. It has to be the right amount of it. It has to be the right amount of softness and sharpness to it. That's really, really important. We saw far too much of this where it just wasn't done very well. It was gratuitous. It was obvious. And in the end, it distracted away from one or two utterly beautiful, beautiful portraits where once the judges had picked up that the background was distracting, it was hard to give it the points that the subject and the lighting originally probably deserved. Over sharpening, this comes up a lot. I did not once hear someone say somebody should have sharpened this image a little bit more. Not once. But I did hear plenty of people say, I don't like the over sharpening. Actually, I heard them say that image is over sharpened. Again, back to my point, as a judge, I can say what I like here, but as a judge, you don't tend to use words like I like, I don't like. You tend to use much more de facto, that image is over sharpened. And over sharpening makes the picture have these little tiny halos around things, and it can look really granular and grainy. Be very careful of that. You're better off underdoing the sharpening than overdoing it. If anything, you can use no sharpening, and I think in the end those images would score better, well, far better than images with too much sharpening. So be very careful not to over sharpen. Color shifts, especially in shadows, especially on skin, e.g. hands, collarbones, legs. This came up quite a bit, and one judge in particular was acutely sensitive to seeing skin where the hands were a different color. The color of the skin on the hands was a different color to the skin on the face, or the color of the collarbone, or the color of, well, I can name any bit of the body really. This is actually a natural phenomenon. If you light a body with a graded light, so if you light a body with a small soft box, bring the box in relatively close, you can try this in your studio, and look at the color of the skin where it's lit really strongly and where it's in the shadows, and you do see color shifts, but some of them were quite marked, and the skin on the face was one tone, it was a peachy tone, and let's say, and the color on the hands was like a bluey purple. It becomes a distraction, and it's not, you don't want the eyes to go down there to the hands and look at the color of the skin. You want the eye to stay with the face, probably, unless you're doing something particular. In those instances, either learn how to recolor the skin. It's very simple, put a coloring layer on in Photoshop, or print the image as a black and white. Either of those will work. It doesn't really matter, but do be aware that if you have different coloured skin and the edges, it will be noticed. This can be particularly apparent where you've applied a vignette badly. If you do a vignette well, so that it leaves the highlights coming through and only marks down the shadows and the lower mids, most skin will actually retain its colour a little bit better. But if you've just whacked on a graded exposure layer, then those bits of skin that are hit by the vignette will change colour. And if that gets spotted by the judges, your image will lose marks. Next one. Dynamic posing, e.g. if a narrative is someone at work, make sure they look like they are at work. Let me say that again. I wrote the note to myself. Dynamic posing, e.g. if the narrative is someone at work, make sure they look like they are at work. There was a couple of really beautiful portraits of a man at work. Unfortunately, the guy was sitting holding the tools of his trade, but sitting looking deadpan at the camera. And he wasn't looking in an engaged way. There was no real connection. And he really didn't look like he was about to do some work. He was in a workshop and it just looked flat and uninspiring, unengaging. And it shouldn't have. It was such a great shot. It was so beautiful. The lighting, the workshop was fantastic. And the author, rather, should have made an effort to make sure that the sitter, the subject of the photo, looked animated and interested and interesting. And it wasn't, it was flat. And we saw this half a dozen times with different authors and different images. If you're going to have a shot that looks like it should have movement in it, make sure the pose has got movement in it. One thing is I did see is that it's very hard to make a pose look like someone is walking when they're not. It is possible, but it's tricky. If you're struggling with that, just get someone to walk and learn how to use the repeat, so the fast shutter repeat on your camera, and pick out the bits that you want. I don't do it that way. I time the shot so it looks like the footfall is where I want it. But I do get people, if I want a shot of people, let's say, moving, walking, I really, really, really do want them walking because that has the natural movement to it. Their hair is moving, the angles are right, their hips are moving. And I think that's a whole lot more interesting than just pretending to do it and having them cross their feet. That's just a point on movement. Last one on compositiony type things. You hear this a lot about the nose breaking through the cheek, but there's dozens of these little rules where the eyelashes show from the furthest eye, or the nose is broken out the cheek, or it's not a full profile, or etc., etc., etc. Chris Bradbury summed this up the best I've ever heard it summed up. And it sounds like, oh, that's just a silly rule. It doesn't really matter if the nose breaks the cheek. What he said was, well, you don't want a bumpy outline to the face, do you? And that's exactly right. You want the outline of the face to be smooth and continuous and having the nose break out the cheek. If you draw an outline of a face with a nose breaking out through the cheek, of course, you're going to have this hard angle where the edge of the nose hits the edge of the cheek as it comes through. And of course, you don't want that. If you've got a beautiful lady, a beautiful face, and you break the nose and you create a bumpy edge. And Chris Bradbury summed that up absolutely wonderfully. And then my last point is, do not plagiarize. Let me say that again, in case you haven't heard it. Do not plagiarize. There was a beautiful image in one particular competition. It did really well. It scored really well. And at the end, after the end of all the presentations, quite a lot of people pointed out that that image was a straight copy of another image that was well known in, I think, the 70s. It was a straight copy. Somebody plagiarized it. Don't do it. It leaves an awful lot of bad feeling. If you get caught early, then it'll simply be removed. If you get caught late, it just creates an awful lot of bad feeling about an image that you really should be celebrating your win, not defending yourself. Do not plagiarize. And on that happy note, it looks like they've stopped. It looks like the sun is going down. The guys have finished. They're all just milling around. I'm assuming my son is going to come and I'm going to take him home. So hopefully you found these observations and things that I've spotted over the years as a judge useful, but don't let that put you off. Just because your image breaks all of the rules does not mean it might not win a competition. Of course, some of the greatest images that we know, and you know this from looking, are just beautiful, and yet they break everything I've just said. They'll be printed on paper that might feel the wrong paper. They'll be exposed in a way that other people wouldn't have done. They'll be cropped in a way that the conventions would say you shouldn't. And yet somehow that is a beautiful image. And we all know that to be the truth. At the end of the day, a great image is a great image. If you love it, try it. You've got very little to lose. And that brings this podcast to a close. So thank you ever so much for listening. And as I start up again and wend my weary way home, have a lovely evening. And remember, be kind to yourselves. Take care.